Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, BC. Can the U.S. ever call an end to its occupation of Iraq and end this war that has become increasingly unpopular with the American public? What are the dynamics in American politics that help explain why they are there? Mark Danner, a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley and frequent contributor to journals like The New Yorker, answers these questions and more in his talk, Lost in the War on Terror, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Endless War, April 10, 2008, at SFU Harbor Center. He was invited to speak at SFU as part of a series of lectures presented by the Humanities Department of SFU under the theme Imagining Citizenship.
It's a pleasure to be here in this beautiful city, which I'm visiting for the first time. I think that the issues I'm going to discuss today have a lot to do with citizenship, with what our, and I say our, talking about Americans, but also I think North Americans as well, our responsibilities as citizens in the so-called age of terror. These responsibilities were brought home very vividly, as it happens this week, in fact yesterday, for those of you who might have been watching at least some of General Petraeus's and Ambassador Crocker's testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in Washington. It was a signal moment, although the press, as often is the case, seems to have buried the lead. The lead was, it seems to me, that General Petraeus declared a halt to the removal of American troops from Iraq, and actually faced the senators and told them that he could not give any estimate for when the removal of troops might resume. That is, that the brigades that had been sent to Iraq by the Bush administration 7 or 8 months ago will be withdrawn up to July, leaving 140,000 American military people in Iraq, which is a larger number than was there before the so-called surge began. And then a period of evaluation would begin, 45 days or perhaps longer than that, for the American military and presumably the political leadership to evaluate whether it is possible to remove any more American troops. And that is all that the general and the ambassador were willing to say, despite a rather vigorous series of questions, in particular from Democratic senators. It was a marvelous moment, actually, when we talk about citizenship, because in that room with General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker was the next commander-in-chief, the next president of the United States, whether that was John McCain, Barack Obama, or Hillary Clinton. And one could see, again, looking at this from the point of view of the citizen watching, one could see the lineaments, the outlines of the coming election campaign in the United States, which will determine so much for how the United States will behave in the world over the next 4 or 8 years, and also, unfortunately, will determine a lot of what the world does in the next 4 or 8 years. I'm sorry to seem like a narcissistic American, but that election, it seems to me, will determine a lot about whether the politics of fear and what I've called in my rather long title, The Politics of Endless War, continues, or whether the United States will change into quite a different power altogether. For those of you who watched that testimony and that questioning, well, I should say at least to me it was fascinating because you could see the coming campaign. John McCain talked about winning, talked about how losing the war in Iraq and losing the war on terror, he took those to be the same thing, was unacceptable to the American people and would not be permitted. Hillary Clinton asked in a rather tortured tone what would need to happen for the war to end, for General Petraeus to recommend that troops could be brought home at an accelerated pace. And Barack Obama actually said, I'm trying here, General, to reach an end point, which was, for those who followed the war closely, a rather ironic line, because a young general, now almost 5 years ago, named Petraeus, was quoted in the Washington Post in 2003 saying, tell me how this ends. It's a famous General Petraeus quote, "Tell me how this ends." And it struck me as remarkable in that Senate room that he was being asked the same question by a very young senator, African-American, who probably would never be in the position of almost securing the Democratic nomination were it not for the Iraq War and the stunning unpopularity of George Bush. With that preamble on citizenship, I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about the war on terror, about the war in Iraq, and the various other aspects of the war on terror. And I'd like to return from there to the implications of the war on terror and the war on Iraq for American politics, and the possibility of a new American politics. First of all, a word of definition. We've used the war on terror, at least in the United States, it's become a phrase so accepted to describe our era that we hardly even notice it anymore. And yet, it's a very strange construction. If you try to analyze what exactly the war on terror is, you find you're looking at, well, the best I can compare it to is a kind of mythical beast, like those you find in Greek mythology, part lion, part goat, part serpent, part man. The war on terror is part traditional counterinsurgency, mountain counterinsurgency, as in Afghanistan. It's part counterinsurgency war, part cum civil war, cum regional war, which you find in Iraq, which I'll talk about in a minute. It is part intelligence war, spy versus spy, fought on the dark side, as Vice President Cheney put it rather famously right after 9/11, in which intelligence agents from many different countries battle insurgents from the southern Philippines all the way to the Straits of Gibraltar. We don't hear very much about this, except when we occasionally hear about yet another extraordinary rendition, or when a Hellfire missile comes down out of the sky and kills several people in Yemen or some other, or South Asia. And finally, the war on terror, and this is a part of it that has that I found particularly fascinating, is part virtual war. That is, the war on terror is a war about ideology. I want to read you the first of several of my favorite quotes from George W. Bush. They're quotes that I've become, I don't know, rather attached to. And this is a quotation from a couple of days after 9/11 when George Bush, it was the beginning of his shining moment as commander-in-chief. He came and addressed the nation in the National Cathedral in Washington. And he said, "Americans do not yet have the distance of history. Our responsibility to history is already clear, to answer these attacks and rid the world of evil." Now, this is an extraordinary statement for a head of state to make. And I still, whenever I read it, and I tend to read it quite a bit, I'm still astonished by it. He was declaring, in effect, and I'll talk about this more later, a perpetual war, a war that is boundless in space and in time, the end of which we cannot see and we cannot even conceive. And it brought to mind, certainly to me and to many others, the best example, the most vivid example I know of perpetual war. And that, of course, is Orwell's treatment in 1984 of the ever-shifting, shape-shifting battle between East Asia, Oceania, and Eurasia, which close readers will remember halfway through, for no apparent reason, shifts. The alliance completely shifts. Orwell wrote about this war that he depicted in 1984, "If we judge it by the standards of previous wars, it is merely an imposture, like the battles between certain ruminant animals whose horns are set at such an angle that they are incapable of hurting one another. But though it is unreal, it is not meaningless. It helps to preserve the special mental atmosphere that a hierarchical society needs." I love that quotation, because Orwell is getting at something that I think is extremely important when we talk about the war on terror. Now, obviously, people are dying in the war on terror. They're certainly dying in Iraq. They're dying in Afghanistan. Many died on September 11th. This is not a war without casualties. On the other hand, the war as it's conceived, which is an endless phenomenon that has to do with good and with evil, has a very clear political utility. It is as if, and this is implied in the Orwell quote, our leaders discovered a way to take the political gold out of war and purify it. In other words, for political purposes, what is useful about war is fear. Fear is the most lucrative emotion, the most lucrative political emotion. And the reason politicians like war, they like it and they don't like it, but what's good about war for politicians is that you can rally to the flag. Patriotism or nationalism, we call it patriotism when it's us, nationalism in other countries, of course. You rally people to the flag, and we see this with the Republican Party, obviously beginning in September 11, 2001. And the wonderful thing about Orwell's quote is it describes a phenomenon by which you can take war, which is expensive, which is bloody, which many people are killed, much is destroyed, much money is spent, and you can, as if, hone it down or reduce it to its most precious ore, which is fear itself. You don't have to have the killing. You don't have to have the destruction. You can just make it a matter of fear. You can talk about Eurasia, East Asia, Oceania, and by doing that, create, and I quote him again, the special mental atmosphere that a hierarchical society needs. We've seen this in the United States since 2001. We see it especially during election cycles. We're seeing the beginnings of it now, because we're about to experience in the United States yet another election that will turn on the fulcrum of fear. And here we get back to Anne-Marie's question of citizenship. Insofar as it will, as the Republican Party wants it to turn on fear, not just fear of another terrorist attack, but fear that the opponent, the Democrat, is not ready, either because that candidate is a female, can't lead the country, or is African-American. We don't know who he is. We don't know where he comes from. But he's not ready. He can't protect you. And insofar as that election, it seems to me, turns on the fulcrum of fear, a question is being put before the American people, which is, are you citizens or are you dupes? That's a harsh way to put it. It's a rather tendentious way to put it, I admit. But we have experienced several elections now. 2002, in which the Republicans ran essentially on Osama bin Laden and won back the Senate, had a historic victory on those off-year elections. 2004, in which George W. Bush was reelected. And then 2006, when for the first time Americans essentially rejected the politics of fear. We're about to see another election in which that will be the critical question, it seems to me. All right, that is a very long prologue on citizenship. I'd like to talk a little bit today about the war in Iraq first. Has anybody ever seen the film Powers of Ten? Powers of Ten is a film, at least I saw it in science class in grade school, and you begin at the atomic level, molecular level, then the level of people, and then it gets bigger and bigger, and you're eventually in the universe. So I'm taking that a little bit from my model tonight. I'd like to begin by talking and trying to sort out the war on terror by beginning at the molecular level, at a particular point in western Baghdad, right there, that's the Tigris River. I mean, I'm going to begin in western Baghdad in a particular point, move out to Iraq in general, move further out to the broader Middle East and American policy there, and finally talk a little bit more broadly about the war on terror and U.S. politics. Right, let's begin here. This is the neighborhood of northern Ghazaliya. It is a mostly Sunni neighborhood, or was, and this is the same city, but shown in sectarian terms. This is in 2003, and we're looking, these yellow sections are mixed neighborhoods of Baghdad. Blue, this is Sadr City, which you've heard so much about. Shia, these are Shia neighborhoods. And the red are Sunni. So this is how Baghdad existed from a sectarian point of view before 2003. It was mostly, as you see, a mixed city. Northern Ghazaliya, I want you to imagine for a moment a very cold dawn, December dawn, in this mostly Sunni, still Sunni neighborhood of western Baghdad. Imagine in the dawn a convoy coming through made up of Iraqi army and U.S. Army Humvees, a couple of tanks, an old Russian armored personnel carrier belonging to the Iraqi army. It goes through a wasteland of garbage and junk. It used to be an athletic field, but the Sunni or the Shia government no longer picks up garbage in Sunni neighborhoods. And this convoy stops, comes to an abrupt halt. Soldiers pile out of their vehicles. The light is just coming up. And among the soldiers is a rather ungainly reporter in body armor and helmet and notebook. He piles out as well. And he runs up to a group of soldiers who are standing grouped around an object on the ground. He's able to look through the various arms and legs and see one soldier use his rifle to push aside a rather slimy bit of cardboard and reveal a couple of bare feet. The body is lying face down. It is naked but for a torn pair of trousers. The hands are tied with wire behind his back. The pockets are pulled inside out. The body looks completely unscathed, unmarked, perfect, until the soldier reaches down very gingerly and pulls him by the shoulder, turns him over, and the reporter sees an enormous crater on the right side of his forehead. He's been executed with a shot to the back of his head. The reporter tries to take all this down in his notebook, but a second later he hears another shout. Another group of soldiers gather about 10 feet away. The reporter walks over, sees another pair of feet extended from the garbage, tin cans, plastic bags, all sorts of awful detritus. But the feet are sticking out. The garbage once again is pulled aside, and the body is turned over. And again, he looks from behind. He's face down. He looks from behind as if he's not been touched. But on turning him over, you can see that an enormous piece of flesh extending from the right ear down the face, all the way down the neck, and over the right top chest has been removed. The translator, whose name code name is Fox, who's wearing, you can tell who the translators are, with Iraqi or American Army units because they're wearing balaclavas, they're wearing face masks to cover their identities, because if their families were known, they'd be killed. The translator whispers in the reporter's ear, "Ah, the dogs have been at him. The dogs have been at him." But the reporter squats down and sees that the wound is very clean. There are no sign of teeth marks, and in fact, some kind of pliers or tongs have been used to penetrate and pull off the piece of flesh while this man was alive. And it's a kind of wound that you see very frequently, sometimes done with electric tools, drills, sometimes done with just with needle nose pliers. And the reporter has seen this before. Anyway, this is the way the day begins in Baghdad during the last phases of the Battle of Baghdad. Now, here you see what the city looked like sectarian-wise before the American War began there. I should add that the reporter asked the translator, "Can you tell whether he is Sunni or Shia?" And the translator answered immediately in that smirking way that the reporter found very annoying, "Oh, obviously he's Shia." And the reporter scratched his head and thought to himself, you know, what am I missing? Is it the pants? Is it the haircut? What is it about these bodies that marks them as Shia? And the reporter was finally forced to ask, well, how can you tell? And the translator said, well, this is still a mostly Sunni neighborhood, which is to say there's nothing in the bodies that tell you who these people are. It's simply if you're in a mostly Sunni neighborhood, because of the process of ethnic cleansing, the bodies that you find will tend to be Shia. If you're in a mostly Shia neighborhood, the bodies you find will tend to be Sunnis, because there is a process underway, and now mostly completed, in which this, a mostly mixed city, turned to a mostly segregated city with very few mixed neighborhoods. Now, those red marks are in part the way this change was effected. Those show, as the map says, bomb attacks with casualties of 10 or more. It's a rather demure way to put it. The Battle of Baghdad was in part carried out by a series of mass casualty bombings of a sort that is absolutely unprecedented. More than 10 of them killed more than 100 people, which is to say vehicles were driven into Shia markets mostly, where people were forced to do their shopping day by day because there's not enough electricity to keep refrigerators going. So marketing public marketing is absolutely a necessity. There's no way to avoid. Trucks would be driven into these marketplaces and exploded. And we've become, of course, very used to reading headlines and stories which say another attack in Baghdad, 23 people were killed, another attack in Baghdad, 70 people were killed, 100 people were killed. But I guess I'd like to make the brief point, because I think it's important to understand the politics of Iraq right now and the impatience that American politicians have on why is there not reconciliation.
This is the local brown bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. You are listening to Mark Danner speak on the American occupation of Iraq. Mark Danner has written about foreign affairs and American politics for more than two decades, covering Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East, among others. He was for many years a staff writer at The New Yorker and contributes frequently to the New York Review of Books, the New York Times magazines, and other publications.
When we realize the way the war has been fought, that is a mass casualty bombing eviscerates very large numbers of people. I mean, this is obvious, but the effect, if you haven't seen it, is very difficult to describe. You have a degree of blood, inches and inches of blood, hundreds and hundreds of body parts. People who have seen this, and you're talking about a large proportion now of the capital city, have had relatives or friends who've been involved in these bombings. People who have seen the results of these are traumatized in a way that's very difficult to convey. I wanted to read you something. It's a rather difficult piece to read. I used it in a piece. It's a description by a family member whose relative was killed in one of these bombings. And she described, it's extensive, and I'm going to read you just a little part of it. It begins when they are told that their nephew is at the morgue. They have to go pick up the body. The men stand up. They're going to go, and as it's proper for men to do, they're going to go get the body. The matriarch of the family goes into hysterics because so many people are killed when they go to the morgue. She doesn't want the men to go. And finally, after a great deal of struggle about this, it's decided that the women will go, which is very unusual, needless to say, and against all propriety. I'll read you a little bit of her account. We were asked to send the next of kin to whom the remains of my nephew, killed on Monday in a horrific explosion downtown, could be handed over. So we went, his mom, his other aunt, and I. When we got there, we were given his remains, and remains they were. From the waist down was all they could give us. We identified him by the cell phone in his pants pocket. This is very common, cell phone service and identification. And in fact, when you hear a large explosion in Baghdad, very often the first thing people will do if their relatives, sons, daughters, whoever are out in the city, they'll immediately call them, which has a couple of effects. One is it jams the cell phone circuits. But secondly, at the scene of these bombings, on the bodies, you will have ringing all over the scene of the actual killing because the phones will start to ring. Anyway, from the waist down was all they could give us. We identified him by the cell phone in his pants pocket. If you want the rest, you'll just have to look for yourselves. We don't know what he looks like. We were led away, and before long a foul stench clogged my nose and I retched. With no more warning, we came to a clearing that was probably an inside garden at one time. All round it were patios and rooms with large pane windows to catch the evening breeze Baghdad is renowned for. But now it had become a slaughterhouse. Only instead of cattle, all around were human bodies. On this side, complete bodies. On that side, halves. And everywhere, body parts. And we were asked what we were looking for. Upper half, replied my companion, for I was rendered speechless. Over there. We looked for our boy's broken body between tens of other boys' remains, with our bare hands sifting them and turning them. Millennia later, we found him, took both parts home, and began the mourning ceremony. So the way this war has been fought has been largely, at least for its opening phase, through 2006, early 2006, was through mass casualty bombings affected by Sunni militias, Sunni insurgents. Many of the more spectacular are carried out by al-Qaeda in Iraq, quote-unquote, which is an Iraqi group, and a very small part of the insurgency, though it's been responsible for many of the very large bombing. And up to beginning in February 2006, you had a reaction. You had Shia essentially starting to kill Sunnis. This was after the destruction of the Al-Askariya Mosque in Samarra, the bombing of the Golden Mosque. And you finally had an eruption of Shia anger. The Shia became convinced that the government was not going to defend them, and they struck back. This, in effect, was what the Sunni militias were trying to achieve. There's a famous letter from the late Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was the head of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, or al-Qaeda in Iraq, until he was killed by an American airstrike some while ago. He sent a famous letter setting out his strategy. Basically, it was one of provocation. If we succeed, he wrote, in dragging Shia into the arena of sectarian war, it will become possible to awaken the inattentive Sunnis as they feel imminent danger and annihilating death at the hands of these Shia. In other words, through mass casualty bombings, you cause a reaction from the Shia. You begin a civil war. The Sunnis are forced to defend themselves. They rise up, which is what Zarqawi was trying to achieve. In effect, what happened was rather different, as you can see by this map and the differences between this map and the former map, which is that the Shia, in essence, won the Battle of Baghdad. If you see that Shia neighborhoods have enormously expanded, they're pushing the Sunnis out of Baghdad. The fascinating thing about Iraq, and fascinating especially to me because I covered the wars of succession in the former Yugoslavia, which this bears some relation to, is that though you have the borders of a national state, in effect, those borders gather within it a kind of crossing ground of ethnic division. The Shia-Sunni divide is one that covers the entire Middle East, but is in essence encapsulated within Iraq itself, within the borders of Iraq itself, which is one of the reasons why when al-Qaeda attacked the United States, Osama bin Laden expected the United States to respond in Afghanistan. The idea was we will trap the Americans in Afghanistan and destroy them as we did the Soviet Union before them. But the United States gave them an enormous gift by invading and occupying Iraq because in Iraq is this ethnic division, sectarian division, that runs across the entire Middle East. And that Osama bin Laden, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and their successors now are playing at to try to create a regional civil war. Let me say a couple more words just about the progress of what is happening in Iraq and the so-called surge. I call it so-called surge because the Bush administration is very good at public relations. You wouldn't quite believe it, since President Bush's approval ratings have been lower than actually any other president since polling began for a longer period. Nixon and Carter have had lower approval ratings on occasion, but Bush has been in the low 30s and high 20s for more than 2 years. But the administration does have some talent in PR, remnant talent in PR, and they called this the surge, and it was a brilliant way to sell it. In effect, the United States sent 26,000 additional troops to Iraq. As you have probably heard, the surge is working, quote unquote, the surge is working. That is the phrase. And indeed, in the last 8 months, the level of violence in Iraq has been reduced, particularly in Baghdad. One of the reasons for that is because this already happened. That is to say that the Battle of Baghdad essentially is over, and the Shia won. That's one reason. A second reason is that the United States, in dealing with the Sunni insurgency, which was based here in Anbar province, there's Fallujah, Ramadi, places that occupied a very strong place on the map of our consciousness, if you follow the Iraq War, that was the heart of the Sunni insurgency. And being supplied from Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. So this is, in effect, the salient of the Sunni world where it meets the salient of the Shia world within the borders of Iraq. Now, the United States, having faced these insurgents for 4 years, made a very American decision. Instead of continuing to fight them, the Americans decided to hire them. And those people, you may have heard a lot lately about tribesmen, Sunni tribesmen. And you might wonder, where did all these tribesmen come from? If you follow the press a lot, you'll think, tribesmen? Excuse me? We didn't hear about them much before. Well, the tribesmen used to go under another name. That name was insurgents. So the insurgents became tribesmen. And in order to make them tribesmen, the United States started paying them $360 a month, anywhere from $300 to $360 a month, basically $10 to $12 a day. And at last count, the United States was employing 91,000 of them. I mean, this was a very smart idea in some ways because it reduced dramatically the level of violence deployed against American troops. It also made it possible to reduce violence without cracking the central nut of the Iraqi political problem, which is political reconciliation, which is who is going to control Iraq. Before the United States invaded, the Sunnis did. The U.S. Staged an election which allowed the Shia to take power, which is the natural thing that would happen because they're 60% of the population. The Sunni have not accepted this. The Shia do not want to integrate the Sunni into the government. The Sunni are not accepting the Shia anyway. So the United States, in essence, hired the Sunni and paid them not to continue attacking Americans and attacking the government. Now, the obvious advantage here is that the level of violence went down. The obvious disadvantage is it's temporary. Or to put it another way, if the point of American policy was to establish a modus vivendi that would allow the United States to gradually withdraw from Iraq, this policy does precisely the opposite. That is, it requires the U.S. presence to keep violence down. It sidesteps the problem of political reconciliation by using American money and American presence to serve as a middleman between the government and the Sunnis that reject the government. The interesting political consequence of this is that let me put it this way, if someone were to come to power in Washington whose policy it was to start removing American troops, it would be almost certain that violence would not only rise as a result of those troops being withdrawn, but violence could rise by an order of magnitude because, in fact, the United States now is arming and training both sides of an paused and or incipient civil war, which is to say there's a very clear political consequence here. If, for example, your policy as a politician has been, if I come to power, I'm going to bring out American troops. And if the Republican argument is, if Democrats come to power, they will lose the war, this policy is almost assured that if Democrats do indeed come to power and begin extracting large numbers of Americans, you'll not only have increased violence, but you'll have violence at an order of magnitude higher than you had before. Courtesy of American training, American arms, American beneficence. So that's the way in which the surge is working. You may have noticed in the last couple of weeks that the Iraqi government moved against Muqtada al-Sadr, who is the leader. He comes from an eminent clerical family. Essentially, two clerical families have run Shia Iraq for the last century, the Hakims and the al-Sadrs. Muqtada is the younger member of the al-Sadr family. He runs a militia and a social movement based in Baghdad, but also extremely powerful in the south. That is really a movement of the sans-culot, you know, of the unwashed. It's based in Baghdad, in Sadr City, which is an enormous, they call it a Shia suburb, it's really a slum, 2 to 3 million people, all of them Muqtada supporters, as they supported his father before him. His father was assassinated by Saddam in 1999, and now Muqtada is the younger member of the family. Facing him in the Iraqi government, Muqtada actually helped with his influence the current prime minister, al-Maliki, come to power. Facing him in the Iraqi government is the younger Hakim, who runs the other major Shia party and is Muqtada's main rival. From President Bush's point of view, what happened in the last couple of weeks is that the young, he says the nascent democracy of Iraq acted to put down militia forces that weren't part of the government. It acted strongly, and though the planning wasn't very good and they had problems, this was a very good sign. That is the Bush administration interpretation. The Iraqi interpretation is that two militias fought one another. One of them had uniforms supplied by the Americans. The other didn't. But they're both Shia movements, both of them part of the government at one time. And at this point, al-Maliki has chosen essentially the Hakim branch, which is, by the way, also more tightly tied to Iran. The last time I was in Iraq, I had the geopolitical situation summarized to me by the inimitable Ahmed Chalabi. Ahmed Chalabi, of course, has become a villain on the American scene. Supposedly, he hornswaggled the United States into invading his country under false pretenses, a notion that I find very amusing. He is, as you can imagine, an extremely charming fellow, very, very smart. And over dinner in Baghdad, he said to me, he gave me the best summary of the geopolitics of the region that I've had. He said, the tragedy, Mark, the tragedy of the Americans in Iraq is that their friends in Iraq are allied with their enemies in the region, and their enemies in Iraq are allied with their friends in the region. Which, you know, I sort of stopped, my fork stopped in midair, and I thought, God, that's such a perfect, brilliant summary. And he's quite right in that the United States invaded Iraq and installed in Baghdad, sponsoring elections, by the way. I mean, it was a real election. A regime that is Shia and allied with Iran. So this particular regime in Iraq now has two major supporters, the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The United States is fighting an insurgency in Anbar province until recently, until it hired the insurgency, but until recently it was fighting an insurgency in Anbar province, a Sunni insurgency that was allied with the Saudis, the Jordanians, Syria is a little bit more ambiguous, but essentially a Sunni insurgency that is allied with, and the Egyptians, by the way, all of the United States' Sunni allies in the Gulf. So Ahmed Chalabi's summary is brilliant because it summarizes this impossible geopolitical position that has its roots really in the project of the war at the beginning, because the war, there is a sense in which, you know, the reasons for the Iraq war are, of course, much debated, much argued about, you know, oil, Israel, Bush's father, you know, you can talk about all of these different reasons. But I want to emphasize one thing, which is the Iraq war, in a sense, was a kind of guerrilla movement within the American government. There was a relatively small group known as neoconservatives who cherished the idea of the Iraq war because they thought it would serve to bring to the region what they called creative destabilization or creative instability. In other words, this war, in a sense, was a way to shake up the entire region. You know, you hear phrases like democratic tsunami, and indeed they had this notion that this would cause democracy to roll through the Middle East. Now you can, you know, curl your lip at that and say, Democrat. They weren't Democrats. And indeed, they weren't really Democrats. But they did have the notion, in its most elaborated form, that if you put a democracy here, or at least an elected government, that it would be very successful, start pumping a lot of oil, establish relations with Israel, among other things, reestablish the Baghdad-Haifa pipeline, so it would be pumping oil through here, and that this shining example of democracy in Baghdad would have its effect in Tehran, where the population, so the thinking goes, is pro-American, even if the government is anti-American. This would cause an uprising in Iran and a pro-American government to be established there. In turn, this would put pressure on the Syrians, who would be forced to come to some kind of deal with the Israelis. It would put pressure on Yasser Arafat, who was still with us at that moment. He would have to make a deal with the Israelis. You would have this sweeping movement throughout the region. Even the Saudis, a key ally of the United States, of course, would be influenced to such an extent they would have to open their system.
This is the local brown bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. You are listening to Mark Danner speak on the American occupation of Iraq.
I mean, I've written about this before, and before the war. These thoughts were around. This is what these people were thinking. You don't have to emphasize the democratic aspect of it particularly. But the thing I think one needs to emphasize is that this was a movement against 50 years of established American policy. That many of these people, after 9/11, pointed to these attacks as a demonstration of the bankruptcy of American policy of supporting dictators in the Middle East. And, of course, they had a point. American policy in the Middle East really begins, I mean, you can, you know, start farther back than this, but I would start it in 1945 with a meeting between King Ibn Saud and FDR in the Great Bitter Lake. It's a fantastic scene where FDR came on his cruiser, the Saudi king came up on board, he presented FDR with a throne, FDR gave the king a plane, it was wonderful, they liked one another, they had talks, you know, the British sun was setting, and it was clear that the United States would be the protector of the Saudis. They came to a fairly simple deal, which said the United States would protect the very rich Saudi kingdom, rich but empty Saudi kingdom, with its military force. The Saudis would ensure a steady supply of cheap oil developed by American companies. And also, by the way, part three of this, often forgotten, the Americans would use their good offices to try to resolve the Palestinian question. This is in 1945. So this was the deal. And, you know, this basic deal is at the root of American policy in the Middle East ever since. Now, obviously, you can give a potted history. It's much more complicated than that. The other key leg of American policy was Iran. The Shah was returned to power in 1953, thanks to a CIA coup. So you have these two bulwarks of American policy. Egypt was added to the quiver in 1973 after the 73 war. Iran essentially became the key player in protecting Saudi Arabia. In fact, the plans in the 70s, as late as the 70s, were if the Saudi kingdom was threatened from within or without, mostly within, the Shah would land troops in Riyadh. And then we had 78, 79, the Iranian Revolution, which of course looms over this entire story. It's the catastrophic key event in recent history in the Middle East. It's how we are where we are. This was a catastrophe for American policy. Suddenly, Iran was not only not an ally, but became an active enemy, pushing Islamic revolution throughout the region. The United States teamed up with the Saudis and with Saddam and fought a war against Iran, a horrible eight-year war in which 500,000 to 1 million died, depending on what estimates you want to take. And there is a fascinating reality here, which is that that line where that war was fought, the United States was supplying arms to Saddam, transshipped through Egypt and Saudi Arabia. The U.S. was supplying money to the tune of $3 to $5 billion to Saddam, given in agricultural credits. The U.S. was supplying intelligence information, including, by the way, satellite targeting data that allowed the Saddam's troops to use chemical weapons on the Iranians. This is weapons of mass destruction. It's a matter of public record. And its allies were the Egyptians, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, poor Kuwaitis, and of course, Saddam was the frontline state. And there's an interesting aspect of this in which, in a funny way, the same geopolitical configuration is going on right now, except that line of battle has moved 200 miles to the west, and it goes right through Baghdad. That's one change. The other change is the U.S. is now supplying both sides. Again, we were in the micro level, now we're on the macro level. U.S. is on both sides of the war. There's another aspect of this, obviously, there always is. After that war, again, we're back to recent history, and I forgive me for how quickly I go through it, but the Kuwaitis had loaned Saddam a great deal of money, as had the Saudis and other Gulf states. They demanded repayment. This is 1989, 1990. Saddam felt that he was defending the Sunni world from Shia revolution. He was the frontline state. It's just like the period after the French Revolution in the late 18th century. He was containing an expansive revolutionary state. He refused to repay. The Kuwaitis insisted. Saddam moved his armies down around Kuwait, deployed them in a way that he knew American satellites would be able to see them, called in the American ambassador and demanded what the U.S. position was. And April Glaspie, who will always be known for this, her one moment on the international stage, told the dictator in her one meeting, "The U.S. has no position on inter-Arab disputes." Anyway, Saddam invaded. George H.W. Bush, having been bucked up by Maggie Thatcher, decided this will not stand. And you had the so-called Gulf War I, or Gulf War II, if you're looking at it from the Gulf, but Gulf War I to us. Now, the interesting thing about this is that just before that war began, as American troops gathered in the desert in Saudi Arabia, a man living in Afghanistan, a rather famous man whose face we all know, flew to the kingdom, his native home, Osama bin Laden, and tried to persuade the king in a meeting with the king not to let these Americans in. Osama bin Laden said, "You know, I've got my own forces. I've been fighting the Soviets. I can defend the kingdom. Don't let these Americans despoil the kingdom." The king listened politely, dismissed him, invited the Americans in. We're at the last point of our, power of 10 here. And we're at the point I'd call the roots of the war on terror. And this is really the story of two generals, Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush. Osama bin Laden had a rather simple goal, which is that he wanted to displace mainly these two regimes, this one, the Mubarak regime in Cairo, and the Saud dynasty in Riyadh, that he considered the great idol worshippers, the secular regimes, and he considers the Saudis a secular regime, who need to be displaced by the new caliphate, by true Sharia regimes. His precursor organizations, Islamic Jihad from Egypt, and Al-Qaeda itself, his own Al-Qaeda, were basically Saudi and Egyptian. These are his two targets. So why attack the United States? Well, they tried throughout the early 90s to attack the Egyptians and the Saudis directly. They had very few encouraging results. These are national security regimes, and the one thing they do very well is keep themselves in power. In fact, it's the only thing they do very well. They have very efficient secret services. They torture people to death. Ayman al-Zawahiri, of course, was famously tortured by the Egyptians. There's actually film of him screaming about it. Osama's number two. They attacked the near enemy directly, Osama bin Laden, without much results. They decided to attack the far enemy. Their reasoning was that neither of these regimes could survive if U.S. support was withdrawn, which was very good reasoning. Mubarak gets almost $3 billion a year from the United States. The regime probably couldn't survive a U.S. aid cutoff. And the Saudis rely, as I've said, extensively on American military and political support. So Osama began a series of attacks beginning in 1995 right here in Riyadh and continuing through Aden, the attack on the USS Cole in Nairobi and Tanzania, the embassy bombings in 98. And eventually, September 11, 2001, the attacks in New York, which, you know, I've written this before, but it's interesting to me that the weapons, we like to talk about the weapons that were used in those attacks as airliners or box cutters, but the true weapon, of course, was the television set. It was the creation of an image by which you not only build recruitment, you show the United States the great empire can be destroyed. You dirty the face of imperial power, which is Menachem Begin's quote about the point of terrorism. Menachem Begin, of course, who was a very successful terrorist before he was Israeli prime minister, he bombed the King David Hotel during the mandate and wrote one of the best books about terrorism that I know. Osama attacks the United States with a couple of goals. One is to build up his own recruitment. We have various tapes, including one in particular, of his discussions after 9/11 when he is immensely concerned about new recruits, particularly in Europe. What did this image of the collapsing towers do to recruitment? And of course, it drove it very effectively. His second goal was to draw, and I mentioned this before, was provocation, was to draw the United States into Afghanistan, as he then hoped. This is why 2 days before 9/11, Al-Qaeda assassinated Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, because they expected that the U.S. would invade, that the Northern Alliance would be the main U.S. ally, and that you have to attack first and destroy this charismatic leader. They killed him by smuggling in a couple of insurgents who were posing as television journalists. They had a camera packed with plastic explosives and blew him up. The idea was draw them into Afghanistan. Of course, the United States avoided the quagmire there, at least in the near term, by relying on air bombardment and using the Northern Alliance as a ground force. The advantage of this was the quagmire was avoided, and the Pentagon was very aware of this danger. The disadvantage was Al-Qaeda, including Osama and Ayman al-Zawahiri, escaped over the border into Pakistan, where we're told they still linger. The United States, though, had a much greater gift in mind, which was the invasion and occupation of Iraq, a much more central state, much more central to Arab concerns, with a much more important history in the Arab world. Afghanistan is an outlier. Iraq is the heart of the matter, where much of early Muslim history took place in the south at Karbala, Al-Qut, and other places. I wanted to talk just a quick moment about the reasons for the war, because it gives me a chance to read another quotation that I really like. It is from Henry Kissinger, when he is asked by a believer in the Iraq War, why did you support the Iraq War? And he said, because Afghanistan wasn't enough. In the conflict with radical Islam, they want to humiliate us, and we need to humiliate them. The American response to 9/11 had essentially to be more than proportionate, on a larger scale than simply invading Afghanistan and overthrowing the Taliban. Something else was essential. The Iraq War was essential to send a larger message, in order to make a point that we're not going to live in this world that they want for us. Now, if the reasons I gave a moment ago, that is the democratic tsunami, could be called the idealist set of reasons, this would be the realist one, that is to restore American credibility through a massive attack on Iraq, shock and awe, a massive demonstration of American power, and television pictures of American tanks rumbling through an Arab capital, television pictures that would erase the humiliating image of the towers collapsing. It didn't quite work out that way. And here we are 5 years later, almost exactly 5 years later. I believe the anniversary of the statue falling in Baghdad, which was the necessary image, sort of poster that the war needed. There's a long shot that the AP took of that famous image of the statue being pulled down on April 9th, 2003. There are a handful of people, there are a very small number of people, that were shot close up. And in fact, the Marines had gone around and called people out. Their PSYOPs forces had gone around and said, come out, come out, come out. And they got people out into the square to do this, to stage this photograph. Anyway, that was 5 years ago yesterday. And even as we sat and watched the commander of American forces in Iraq essentially refused to talk about an ending to the war, essentially insisting that there would be in July 140,000 troops, 8,000 more than there were a year ago, and there could be no promise of fewer, and approaching an election campaign in which this will be central once again, that is, who can be elected in the United States, who can protect Americans, and win the war, win, quote unquote, win the war. We're at a moment, I guess, central to the question of who we are as citizens. But I want to say just a word about American ideology, because one of the fascinating themes here, it seems to me, is, and I referred to it a little while ago when I quoted President Bush's wonderful lines about ridding the world of evil, the need that Americans seem to have for an ideological mission in the world. And, you know, one can point to President Bush's rhetoric, and I love to do it. I love quoting his speeches because they're wonderful speeches. They're brilliant. He's had great speech writers. They're just completely crazy. But the problem is that if you actually look at these closely in the context of American history, you find that the echoes are striking with the beginning of the so-called American worldwide mission after World War II. That is, the echoes, in particular, of the Truman Doctrine appear everywhere in Bush's speeches. The Truman Doctrine, you might remember, was adumbrated, I guess is the word, in 1947. And the immediate history was the British ambassador came to see Dean Acheson in the State Department and said, you know what, we're pulling out of Greece and Turkey. We can no longer sustain our involvement there. There were insurgencies in both countries, communist insurgencies, and if you want to keep Greece and Turkey in the western side, as it were, you're going to have to supplant us there. You're going to have to take a role there. And this, of course, was unprecedented in American history, a sort of permanent role in Europe. Truman knew how controversial it would be. He also knew, though, and like many of his generation, he had fought in World War I. He thought the catastrophic failure of the United States was to, in this great set piece of diplomatic struggle after World War I, was to refuse to join the League of Nations, and that this had led to the Second World War. And he was convinced that this couldn't happen again, as was George Kennan and various other people we refer to now as the wise men, or at least some people do. Truman was advised, in order to get American support for this kind of permanent role in Europe, he had to go before Congress, and in the words of the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to scare hell out of the American people. Or as Acheson said later, make things clearer than truth. And thank you very much for your kind attention.
You have been listening to The Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. On today's Brown Bagger, Mark Danner has analyzed the American presence in the Middle East and their war on Iraq. You can download this speech at www.echoshock.net/brownbagger. Thanks for listening. Tune in next Tuesday at 12 noon. Yeah.